Committee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Excuse me? In the back?
Thank you.
Ozzy knows better than this. Okay. Open the meeting. Would the committee assistant please note that Representative Morgan is excused, and so is Senator Whitsitt, and Senator Walker is excused for the time being, but is expected shortly. We will start off again with the Department of Education, Operations, Grants, and Aid. Ms. Fleming.
Good morning, Chair Gilblin and members of the committee. Back again. The plan that we have for this morning's presentation is first to give you a little bit more information about the agency and the questions that you've been bringing up about what it is that we do and our commitment in the beginning and our opening day, that you understand that fully. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the agency, the accountability work that we do, the reorganization that we've been undergoing and what that really means and how it's manifesting itself in us doing things differently at the department. And then Brett's going to take over and begin to go through program explanations, and which will lead up to our conversation about budget reductions. So that's the plan. Starting on slide 20 this morning, in our skipping around in this quest to be flexible, we've mentioned repeatedly since we started that the department is an agency in transition. And I want to reinforce that. 2 years ago, this committee that was chaired by Representative Susan Morgan, the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education, affirmed and supported our plan to change the department from an organization that was a bit confused about its core mission to one focused on system accountability. And that's what we're going to go into detail about this morning. Really mentioned previously that the issue of performance measures and the fact that we are in process with those is largely about the last 2 years of our reorganization and work. And if you'd indulge me for a minute, I'd like to quote from the book Banishing Bureaucracy, because I think it describes very accurately what it is that we've been trying to do with the organization. In the book Banishing Bureaucracy, which is the first in a series of three, which now has led to the Price of Government authorship, which seems to be one of the popular tomes that's floating around the Capitol, they propose a core strategy as one of the ways to begin the conversation. The core strategy really is about helping public systems clarify their fundamental purpose, eliminate functions that no longer serve the purpose, organize their activities so that each part of the organization is free to focus on its well-defined mission, and all of which are supposedly to contribute to the system's overall purposes. That really is the premise upon which we've been reorganizing and redesigning our work at the agency. And simply put, we've been in a process of differentiating the steering functions of the system from the rowing functions. So, again, in their explanation of what that means, steering is about policy development and regulation. Rowing is about service delivery and compliance. So when we talk in our opening remarks about a regional service delivery system, we really are talking about that system providing the service delivery and assisting us with compliance and the agency's work to focus on policy and regulation. So let me just one more caution about that regulation. There's a continuum. I think people often react strongly to that word. There's a continuum of a regulatory function that goes all the way from being very strict in terms of following the rules to something that you could describe at the other end as being developmental. Activities that we do at the department fall all along that continuum of being very regulatory to very developmental. We have the responsibility, if we learn about some issue of public health or safety with children, to act immediately in a very regulatory fashion. At the other end of the continuum, developmentally, we are tasked to create a system of support for school improvement. Well, that's a very difficult and broad scope of work with 198 districts and 20 ESDs, and is very formative in its nature, and will take us a great deal of time to get better and better at that. We have some capacity in place in the system, but not enough. As the expectations have increased with No Child Left Behind, we need to find more capacity to do that work. I'm going to skip to slide 28, because I think it sort of captures and reinforces the idea that we were just talking about, that we really have reorganized to accommodate systemic change. And the fundamentals that you see before you on this slide are really good descriptions of what that means to us. Let me give you a few examples. We came to the interim committee last spring with news and information about one of the things that we had discovered internally at the department, and that was that we had been funding a set of transition services for the youth corrections education population that, in fact, was being funded with the state school fund after we had been advised by the Attorney General that that was an inappropriate use of money. We have acknowledged that. We immediately terminated those contracts, and we will be working with you and the committee to talk about what we do to remedy that money in the state school fund. We have sought legal advice from our council about how that should work in order to put the money back where it belongs. We also have reorganized our work units. Prior to the reorganization, all of our offices were really structured around federal grant programs. So, for example, all of the title programs under Elementary and Secondary Education Act were in one office. The professional technical education grants, Carl Perkins, were in another office. So you can imagine in a bureaucracy what kind of behavior that created. We had multiple and redundant processes. We had, for example, if someone was set about monitoring a program, each office would have a different strategy for how that might work, which led to things happening in the enterprise, like the story that one of our education specialists tells. She showed up in the parking lot at the Condon Elementary School one day and found two other cars, state cars from the Department of Education, one from the Office of Special Education and the other from Curriculum Instruction, none of the three of them knowing that the others were going to be there that day. So, big problem, and it's one that we've taken on and have addressed. The district and school improvement processes that I mentioned, the office led by Dr. Salam Noor, Educational Improvement and Innovation, was previously three different offices. It was Professional Technical Education, Curriculum Instruction, and Student Services. So federal programs, professional technical, and all of the state work around Oregon's Educational Act for the 21st century. So there was a math specialist in one office and an industry and engineering specialist in another office, and they were both talking about how high schools should work better for students, but not necessarily talking with one another about how programs and curriculum could be integrated and how that work could be combined. And so now those specialists are in the same office. We have a much more integrated and clear way of thinking about what we're saying to school districts about what should be happening, what the research says are best practices, and in fact have seen a great deal of improvement about how that works. Again, back to that notion of enterprise thinking, there's a huge opportunity cost to not working well with our multiple stakeholders, and so I want to go back to reminding you of what we talked about initially, which was that we have a public education advocates, school boards, administrators, teachers, parents, and we have really honored that commitment to work with the community colleges and workforce development office. When Brett gets into our programs, one of the programs he'll talk about is the Perkins Grant. That money comes into Oregon about $14 to $15 million is split equally between the community college system and the K-12 system, which means we need an interagency agreement to be able to work together with them and to develop programs that work better for students between the end of high school and the beginning of their post-secondary experience. And Senator Gordley's mentioned yesterday of the expanded options policy work is all about that. So, go back to the basics. The only reason the department really exists, the reason that the legislature sets policy and the state board interprets policy and the department implements that directive is to support student success. The role of the agency primarily set expectations and standards, measure against those standards, monitor and report progress on those standards, and hold districts and schools accountable for that progress. As we mentioned in the first day, there are lots of different kinds of standards. Standards for system development for district and schools, standards for student achievement, and standards defining program quality and operations. And there are multiple parties interested in changing, refining, and raising those standards, Congress being one and the legislature being another, and we are in acting in response to those changing expectations at the department. We talked about what specifically the department does to provide accountability to know that those standards are being met. So, quick bullet list, just as a reminder. We develop and administer reliable tests. You're looking at a slide and trying to make sense of this. I've sort of changed my order here. Go to 22. The assessment system is one that we'll be probably spending quite a bit of time talking about. It is the way that we, in fact, know whether students are making progress and can report to you in a standards-based system what that progress looks like, and you heard a great deal of that information from Dr. Brooke yesterday. We develop administrative rules, program guidance that communicates changes in policy. Every time Congress or the legislature changes the law, our responsibility is to interpret what that means and be able to communicate to the field, so that they can, in fact, implement those changes. We implement and manage programs, and you'll be hearing about many of those today. We collect and analyze a variety of data, financial data, program data, student-level data. We report performance to the executive branch, legislative branch, and schools, and the general public. We provide that infrastructure to support data collection, reporting, and analysis through technology and various applications. We assist teachers in creating standards-based curriculum. We manage state and federal funds. We report on the management of those funds. We monitor for compliance and results. Very important issues such as civil rights. We distribute and provide oversight for the state school fund, and we hold ourselves accountable for effective operations. So let me give you just a sense of the broad scope of state and federal mandates that the department is responsible for, and as I said, Brett will be going into much greater detail about this later this morning. We manage and provide oversight for over 45 federal programs, including the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, No Child Left Behind, the Head Start investment, along with Oregon's investment in early childhood, child nutrition, and again, the Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Act. We have multiple grant and aid programs, youth corrections education, juvenile detention education. We manage the transportation programs for the state. And in addition to that, we have our own vision in Oregon for how our schools should look, which is has been grounded in Oregon's Educational Act for the past many years. It comes with a great deal of scope and many mandates included in that as well. We set standards in 7 areas of academic content, and those standards don't just get set once and then stay stagnant. Obviously, the world changes, and they have to be reviewed and revised and updated on a regular rotation. Again, we design and implement a statewide assessment system. Last year, we gave over 1 million tests, both in paper and pencil form and through technology, through our technology-enhanced student assessment system. And we support continuous improvement efforts. And we're redesigning that notion. And I can talk to you a little bit. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the continuous improvement process, because that is a mandate that came from the legislature in order to be able to report progress to the public. We provide leadership. Issues that we've mentioned about the superintendent's priorities, closing the achievement gap, literacy, and middle and high school improvement are the priorities that Superintendent Castillo has set. And we promote innovation. It's very hard to imagine that we would have a vision in Oregon and we would convey that vision verbally and expect that it would magically happen. We have several projects in a variety of different venues that are about testing whether the policy that we have created is actually coming to fruition and is an advantage to students. And a lot of that work right now is going on in our high school reform efforts. So how does that translate into the agency's work? I just want to offer you a couple of, I think what I'd like you to have after we get done today is a sense of the scope of the breadth of the responsibilities that the agency has. But also want to take it down to a personal level for you just for a moment. I asked a couple of our assistant superintendents yesterday to give me a little bit of information about the multiple program areas that staff at the department are carrying responsibility for now. And they provided me with a great list. No one has the luxury of assigning their time to one specific set of tasks, but rather multiple responsibilities. We have one staff person who's responsible for work in alternative education. He's the only person in the department that we have that is assigned to knowing what's going on in alternative education programs in the state, is responsible for training and letting the field know what the administrative rules around that say and what we should be doing to accommodate that population of kids that often end up in the second chance tier of our work. He's also responsible for working with high school reform, that research and development projects around the state that we have high schools trying out and continuing to devolve our work on the policy level. He's responsible for the credit options project, which means, again, that we have innovations popping up that people say, we want to try this, and we support them by both giving them, at times, some grant money to support their work and also to help us glean the information back so we can bring it back into the policy discussion with the state board. And he's a regional liaison, so each of these people has an assignment where they are to stay in contact with a region of the state so that that group of districts in that region have somebody they can call at the department to ask questions that they can go and find out information for them. So it's just a sense of the there are many other examples of that. I want to skip for a moment to go back to that work on accountability. In your notebooks, there's a tab that says accountability, and there are two documents in that tab, one titled Introduction, Oregon's Educational Accountability System for Education, and the other is titled A Continuous Improvement Planning Framework. I want to talk for just a minute about that continuous improvement planning framework. As I mentioned, we have many federal grant programs and many state mandates. And often what that results in, if we aren't careful about thinking through the alignment of our work, results in confusion and redundancy and a focus on the wrong things. The work that we're doing around accountability really encompasses this continuous improvement process. Several years ago, the legislature handed the department a mandate to have an annual consolidated district improvement plan for every school district in Oregon. And in addition to that, there was a requirement under the federal grant programs that another application and another set of reports be submitted. This work that you see in this continuous improvement process is about integrating those two processes so that we don't have a federal set of requirements and a state set of requirements. But in fact, if you look at, I'm not sure the pages are numbered, but there's one page that is titled Standards and Indicators, Continuous Improvement Planning. Looks like this. This is an attempt to set forth a common set of uniform standards for continuous improvement of Oregon school districts and schools. The work behind it is that how do we get an application that accommodates all the federal grant requirements and reporting that we need to do and meets the expectation that you set forward about you knowing on an annual basis what districts are doing to plan for their own continuous improvement. So you can see that this lays out six common standards, and these standards are really based in research. These are the things that we need to look at clearly, and that research has borne out are the most important things to look at to know and identify our actions that we take to address what is happening with our student population and what schools need to do to improve. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail around that. I just wanted you to know that this is all about the new work of the agency, which is about not having redundant processes and tools that collect information that are compliance-oriented, that don't actually focus on helping schools improve and helping them ask the right questions of themselves so that they know what works.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good morning, Ms. Fleming.
Good morning.
The new system that you are, of accountability that you're describing and defining, is going to be dependent on data, being able to acquire and use good data. Looking at one of your key indicators for the organization, which is in transition, as you've noted, I'm looking at page 27 in the key indicator, data quality. Currently, no standards or training to districts, but where we want to get to is having standards on data quality and the department having the capacity to provide training. Would you talk about that piece in terms of when we will be there? Timeline.
Great. Chair Devlin, Senator Gourley, thank you. That was a great segue into that next part of what we really want you to understand, and that is really where were we when we began this reorganization and where we want to go. The data integrity and the data quality and the tools that we developed to collect data and give it back to districts is a huge part of our conversation, and was really one of the major parts. We talked yesterday about the K-12 integrated data system and the premise that we can't improve unless we do have good data, and it is meaningful and relevant data. Part of that proposal is about accelerating our timeline. We have internally, where we are now is we've internally have a group we call the Data Owners Group that really has identified staff in the department, throughout the department, across all of our offices that are responsible for collecting and managing and reporting on various aspects of what happens in Oregon schools. You remember that in our first day we talked about Susan talked about the redundant data collections and that we've tried very hard to reduce the number of surveys that we're sending to districts and asking for information. We're going to continue to work on that. So I would say, in answer to your question, Senator Gourley, we'll be working on this forever, and that the proposal for the K-12 integrated data system, right now we're building a business case for technical infrastructure consolidation, and the work of the agency is to identify internally what we're doing well or not so well, to develop discipline processes about how we collect data. If we collect data for one grant program and it doesn't need to be collected for another about the same kids or the same variables that we're asking about, then we need to stop doing that. So the timeline, when will we be done and when will it be perfect? I really can't answer that question, but it's really high on our list of things that we want to do better. And, in fact, on behalf of kids, it is the main event, assessment data, achievement data, et cetera. Let me talk a little bit more about those two slides on...
Ms. Fleming, I had a question in addition to that. The issue of data, obviously the issue is one of quality, not of volume of data.
Yes.
And my superintendents, who I hear from on a fairly regular basis, perhaps one of the principal complaints they have is multiple redundant reports. In that vein... not tomorrow, but next week. Could you give us a list drafting of all the reports that a school district would have to give to the Department of Education, and also some expectation about, this would be next week, some expectation about through your efforts, through the department's efforts, how that might change over the next 2 years, particularly if we were going to adopt a performance measure that had anything to do with data collection.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We just finished the list of surveys, and it's posted on our district website of all the things for the coming year that will be due, what the date is. Over time, we've automated a great deal of that data collection surveys. It was part of the database initiative and the building out of that technology infrastructure and, in fact, have just in the last year done a survey of everything that happens in the department to be able to know. We, interestingly enough, have multiple staff members who kept databases at their desktop about the information that they needed to collect for their program, for their particular grant compliance. And so the work is about where does the information reside? Is it redundant? How do we minimize that impact?
In that report that you give back to the committee, could you list all documents that school districts have to submit to the Department of Education?
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. And kind of following along that thing, I was looking at your standards and indicators under the accountability part of it, and it just seems to me that, well, like under curriculum, how do you make sure that each one of the 198 school districts answer the 6 subsections under curriculum? Or how do they answer the 14 subsections under instruction, or the 8 subsections under district culture and norm, and the 3 under, I mean, you see where I'm going with this thing? I mean, when I look at this thing, if you're going out and saying, oh, we're going to require this of all these school districts, oh my God, when do they have time to teach?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, this is meant to provide a broad framework with a set of standards and a set of indicators. And it's really a tool for a district to take and do their own self-assessment to determine where they are. And if there is a need for improvement, then they can decide what the actions will be and what the resources they will use to make that improvement happen. This is less about compliance and more about a focus on continuous improvement and framing and describing in very clear, objective terms what it is that the research says you need to pay attention to accommodate better student success. So the whole idea behind this was that we wouldn't have multiple reports that we asked districts to submit, but that we would focus on what matters, which is a clear set of standards. So if I were a district superintendent, I could look at this, and if I didn't have a strategic plan or a continuous improvement plan already in place, I would be able to take this, sit down with my management team, go through standard by standard and say, how are we doing on this standard and this set of indicators, and where do we need to pay attention in the next year or 2 years to be able to address the needs of students in our district?
Just to follow up, yes. I mean, to me, it's, you know, if I was saw this, I'd say, where are we doing all these things? I mean, most of the school districts have these out there. Or how do you find accountability? How do you go out and say, you're not doing this right, you're not being accountable? Or do you do anything along those lines?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that's a very good question.
Yeah.
It isn't so much about checking off the list in terms of how are we doing, but looking at the data that Senator Gordley mentioned and the student population. If there is a population of students, now that we have disaggregated and student data at an individual level, that the data tells us are not doing as well as we would like, then that would trigger a set of questions. And the set of questions would be related to these standards and indicators. What the department would do is ask for this plan on an annual basis, and I want to go back to that regional service delivery system. Where does the technical assistance and support come from? That's where we need additional capacity. And I'd just like to mention that in conversations with some of the ESD superintendents around the state, the set of questions that have been triggered by No Child Left Behind and our disaggregating of the data and looking at individual cohorts of students is causing them to look at their resources and capacity and ask different questions about what they need to be spending their federal and state resources on. An example of that, we know that many of the school districts that are on lists of not making adequate yearly progress are related to their populations that have second language needs, are limited in their English proficiency, and special needs students. So what does that mean? It means there's expertise in the enterprise that we need to get directed to those schools and districts and that population of kids. So it's about finding the resources and the capacity in the system to direct back to the districts as they look at their data and identify their needs. So it really, another example of that is in the resolution process, I'm told by Maureen Casey at Willamette ESD that in this recent round of resolution, the district receives the money for Title I programs. They have a need for understanding more about their assessment system and about the data, what the data tells us about their student population. So they're buying from the Education Service District additional services to support that data analysis so that they can serve that population of students in a better fashion. So it's not as much about checking off the list or requiring districts to do something as it is about having a common framework for improvement.
Okay, just one more. Under the personnel, under standards, standard two instruction, you know, teachers are, it's number nine, teachers are culturally competent. I mean, as a practical matter, at least in my part of the country, and probably it's true of a lot of places, we just sometimes have a hard time getting teachers to stay. And, you know, whether they're culturally competent, this may not be the deciding thing. I mean, to me, this is fine and wonderful. We have a lot of extra money to spend and do all these things, but I mean, we're in a situation where we don't have that money. So, you know, it goes back to what can we do with what we've got, and is this creating too great of a burden upon our school districts, so that they can't actually do the thing that they're supposed to be doing, is instructing children and teaching them, you know, on the ground, and you know, and the accountability thing. I mean, this is trying to get to the accountability. As a parent, if I want some accountability how my child's doing, I go to the teacher. I'm not going to come to the State Board of Education. So I think there's, you know, I'm struggling with this concept of accountability and how you actually get to it. I mean, it's on the ground where the work is being done. That's where I think the accountability really is. So if we have to reallocate these scarce resources, you know, I'm going to direct my focus on that. I'm
at
the school teacher.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I appreciate those comments greatly, and I think you're expressing some of the same conversation that has gone on in the Quality Ed Commission about shared accountability and who is responsible for what, and ultimately it is the child and the teacher and the parent in a community. I just want to remind you that we don't dream this stuff up on our own. We're grappling with a set of federal and state mandates that require us to respond. And really what we've been trying to do at the department is reduce the redundancies, align those policies, create tools that don't make districts jump through multiple hoops, but in fact you submit one application that hopefully is relevant and meaningful and meaningful to you in your context, not just something that the department collects and puts in a drawer somewhere and checks off that we've met the federal requirement. So the goal is all about getting better in the system at continuously improving what does the data tell us we need to be focusing our time, attention, and resources on, and how do we get the capacity to you to help that happen. So thank you for asking those really great questions.
Ms. Fleming, before we go on, I'd like to let the committee know that on the dais is a report on the task force report on ESDs that's been prepared by some of the ESDs in the state along with other participants, including, I believe, the Department of Education participated in that task force. We all know that there are reorganization bills, I believe, both in Senator Walker's Education Committee and in Representative Flores's Education Committee in the House. While we may touch on ESDs later this week, next week we will be discussing ESDs, but we're not doing that to make any decisions. We're doing that so that the committee is appraised, because either or both bills come from one chamber or both chambers ultimately to this committee, because either would have a fiscal impact. And so just so that the committee can be more aware of the issues surrounding ESDs, but we will be discussing ESDs in some detail next week. So Senator Walker, that was.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's quite timely because our policy committee will begin a discussion on Monday, the 7th, and have a presentation from the task force, yeah. And also the bill is presently sitting in our committee. And then we're going on the road next Friday to Douglas County to their ESD, and we will patch in ESDs from the South Coast, hopefully, and Medford, and maybe from the East for that discussion. So I'm glad it worked out the way it did. Okay. We'll have a busy week.
Ms. Fleming, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you'd just indulge us for five more minutes, we want to brag a little bit about the work that we've done in the last couple of years and help you get an understanding of where we were and where we are now and how far we have to go yet so that you can continue to deepen your knowledge about what the agency does. We were a state agency that, in fact, took advantage of the fact that we're led by a separately elected state official and at some points along the way ignored the rules, and now have become an agency that really is about playing by the rules, being transparent and open with you, and we aspire to be one of the best state agencies in Oregon state government. We have a clear mission. We were, as I mentioned, trying to be all things to all people, and we had people picking up the phone and responding to every call that came through without really thinking about the discipline of the organization or where our capacity really should be focused. We now have a clarified role, as I mentioned. We hope to be one that is focused on clear implementation of policy and high performance levels. Our commitment to customer service and transparency, I hope, will become more and more evident to this committee as we go through the next several days as well and answering your questions. It's a very opaque and complex enterprise, lots of different mandates, lots of different funding streams. We want you to be able to understand that, and we want the general public to be able to understand that, to address the perception that we mentioned the first day we met, which was that that people believe that the money may not be spent as effectively as it might. Our management controls were quite lax. 2 years ago, we began implementing more discipline, particularly around our budget development and our data quality, et cetera. We hope to be a system that has formalized and disciplined processes and management controls that really work. Data quality, we've already talked about. This is a really important issue for us. You can see that the resources in the agency, if you looked at how the people are deployed over time, much more of our staff have been directed and will continue to be directed to that data quality, data integrity function. Again, our internal relationships, we were siloed offices around federal grant streams. We're currently making changes in that through our organizational structure, and our ultimate desire is to be very integrated and have one brain with all the synapses firing in our new organization. Budgeting, same problem. We were in silos. We now have a budget that is consolidated. We have a very granular level of detail to describe to you about the functions and activities of our offices and our units and individual staff members, which will help us inform us and make better decisions about budgets in the future. Our internal operations, and Brett can tell you more about this, but we're somewhat out of date and inefficient. We have automated many of our processes. We have an electronic grants management system, which now allows each of the persons responsible for those federal grants to go into an electronic system and manage the same information in the same way. So we have apples and apples. We can go in and we can get information about federal spending, et cetera, without going to a dozen different people at a dozen different desks. And last but not least, we have received a significant amount of criticism, and you have a Secretary of State's audit in your book that outlines what some of those issues were in the past. Spent a lot of time on our contracting practices, really were very poorly executed in the past. We're now in compliance with BATS rules. We have a procurement coordinator that coordinates all of that work for us. And we aspire to be an agency that manifests best practices in that arena.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Ms. Fleming, you mentioned Secretary of State's audits, and I recall that this question came up in part the other day, but could you speak to the Secretary of State's proposal to conduct audits on school districts? I think it's a $1.3 million request, and it would require a number of auditors to fan out and focus on what's happening in districts out there. You don't have the capacity as a district to do what you don't have the capacity as a department to do what the Secretary of State is proposing. Have there been conversations with the Secretary of State about what he's proposing and how these processes could work together?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, there have been informal conversations. The superintendent, I believe, has not taken a firm position on that, particularly related to who would pay for it, and I won't get into that at this point. But in general, I think the conversations that we've had in the agency is that we know that we need to focus on continuous improvement, and we know we need additional capacity to do that. I think the question is, where does that additional capacity come from? If it doesn't come from the department, doesn't come from the ESD system, there's a need for clarification of what that proposal really does propose in terms of performance audit. In our view of the world, we need additional capacity to help districts get better at what they do. And if there's some assumption that a performance audit would do that, then I think be more inclined to see that as a good idea. If it's only about compliance and regulation and finding things that are not going well, then I'm not sure about that. The $1.3 million, I believe the proposal is for that to come from the state school fund, and I believe the superintendent has said that's not a strategy that she could support. I know that we talked the first day about having hired an internal auditor, and the clarification of that role for us is that person is not there to do to go into our agency and find things that are going wrong, but in fact to look at all of our management controls and our processes and identify risk and help us decide what we need to focus on first and what we need to do about it. And that has been a very helpful role for that to be added to the agency's work.
The funding, if I may continue,
yes.
The funding for the Secretary of State's proposal aside, is it your statement then that the proposal does have merit and deserves to be fleshed out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe that that's a conversation that's worth having.
Understanding, Senator Gordley, that Ms. Fleming is obviously in a difficult position because the superintendent has not taken a position yet.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, if you're asking about whether the dedicated resources to help schools improve would be a worthwhile investment, I believe the answer from the agency perspective would be yes. Whether or not it comes in the form of a performance auditor, I would leave as an open-ended.
What's behind my question, and I appreciate what you're trying to say, Mr. Chair. What's behind my question is the other conversation we started the other day about how do we convince the public, those who are not yet convinced that we're spending money wisely in school districts. How do we get there?
Right.
And that's what's behind my question. I'm not trying to put you on the spot or the superintendent on the spot. Just trying to gain an understanding.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would say something just briefly about that. I think a number of people have expressed concerns about the money coming from the state school fund, and also a number of people have indicated that if the audits were driven by questions that have arisen both inside and outside this building, and you were trying to address those questions and to try to find some answers to them, example, is there more that we should do in terms of transportation costs for school districts or other specific areas, then I think people, at least that have talked to me, have seen some benefit in that. If it is going out just trying to find, I think as you expressed, just an errant school district here or there that may not be performing in one way or another, something that you could highlight in a news story, it's probably not going to help the process here very much. But there may be some questions where we would like to have answers, where it's difficult sometimes to get those answers. I'll leave it at that. Ms. Fleming, let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I want to offer the concept paper that our internal auditor has written, and I did not bring copies of that with me this morning, but we certainly could bring those tomorrow, which really do describe all the dimensions of the audit function and what possible value there would be to the enterprise about that.
Great.
I think we're going to move now to talking a little bit about the organizational structure, and then I'm just going to turn it over to Brett, and we'll begin to go through program by program. Again, each of the offices you'll see are named with functional descriptions. So finance and administration, which is Brett's responsibility. Educational improvement and innovation is the office that I mentioned that was three offices combined into one. Development of academic content standards happens there. Management of the federal programs around No Child Left Behind and professional technical education. The student learning and partnerships unit is responsible mostly for direct services to students and children that are both in early childhood programs and incarcerated youth, and long-term care and treatment hospital programs, regional programs for special needs students. The Systems Accountability and Policy Development Unit is the one that we have charged with figuring out all of that information that floats around that agency, and what do we collect and what do we do with it once we collect it, and how can we get it back to districts in a way that is helpful, and how can we reduce the burdens on those reporting requirements. Assessment and Information Services was a combination of what was formerly our technology unit and our assessment and evaluation units. As you know, most of the assessment system relies on technology, and so the combining of these two units has made us able to do our work more efficiently. The superintendent's office, obviously, is responsible for leadership, setting the priorities, helping talk about what's important in Oregon schools. We have a federal liaison that is our person in Washington, D.C., goes back and forth and helps us understand what's going on with the various reauthorizations that are happening currently, and keeps us in the driver's seat in terms of our ability to communicate through our congressional representatives what it is that we would like to see changed or influenced in the federal process. Dr. Burke is our chief policy officer, and as you know, is sort of the brains of the outfit. Randy Harnish is the executive staff to the State Board of Education, reports directly to the State Board and to the Deputy Superintendent, and then the internal audit function. Our Chief of Staff has a responsibility for overseeing the communications function of the agency, and the descriptions and the little boxes under each of those offices really gives you a little bit more insight about what the responsibilities are in those units. So I'll stop there and let
Question.
Brett.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Looking at this organizational chart, could you provide even more clarity about the role of Chief of Staff? You said that that's a communications function. Is there a supervisory function that is inclusive of all the other positions in the organization? Or I'm trying to understand that role as contrasted to the role of the deputy superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the only supervisory responsibility that the Chief of Staff currently has is over the staff that do communications, and right now we have two FDE devoted to that function. He reports directly to the State Superintendent, advises and guides policy and issues related to her leadership role.
Is that person an educator?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley.
The Chief of Staff.
He has a variety of different job descriptions in his background, but is not a licensed educator to my knowledge.
In terms of history in the organization, has there always been a Chief of Staff with a communications function? Refresh my memory.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I've only been there a couple of years myself, not a great historian. I believe there always has been someone who has functioned in the role of advising the state superintendent, the elected superintendent. Whether or not that title has always come as Chief of Staff, I couldn't say, but we could go back and do that historical research for you.
This kind of goes back to the question that Senator Nelson raised the other day about, you know, when you're looking for where there might be other reductions in the department. I think you threw out $20 million. I know this isn't a $20 million position, but, and I'm not trying to make anyone nervous out there. I'm just trying to understand the function in its overall relationship to everything else that goes on in the organization. So, thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett West, Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Administration, and we'll begin this part of the presentation on slide 41. The way we have this presented here is according to the way our budget is broken down within the governor's budget and within the state's budgeting system, ORBITS. We have the six categories that you can see here: department operations, special schools, youth corrections, juvenile detention, grant made, state school fund, and debt-related costs. And we'll go into each of those in a little bit more detail as we move along today. You've heard quite a bit about the department operations portion of the budget, so I won't spend a whole lot more time on it right now. But I do want to make sure that we say that the primary purpose of our work in the department is to support and enhance student learning. I think there was some discussion earlier in the week about that connection, and I think without the school districts and the need for data analysis, those types of things, getting the money out the door, we wouldn't need to exist. And we do this work of supporting student learning by implementing state and federal law, distributing state and federal dollars in a timely and accurate manner. We established those clear expectations that Vicki was talking about earlier on student learning. We develop and administer tests to judge how students are doing against those expectations that we've set. We collect and analyze the data, and we report it out to the public, to you, and to school districts so that they can make changes as necessary. And we provide oversight and regulation for education programs around the state, and these are set in public schools, ESDs, hospitals, and a variety of other settings. We see our target groups as you, the public, staff, and faculty of school districts and ESDs, internal partners among ourselves, and other state agencies, including Legislative Fiscal Office and the Department of Administrative Services. We also work closely on some programs with the Department of Human Services, the Commission on Children and Families, and other such groups. Since we've spent a lot of time so far, and we'll go into more detail tomorrow, what I'd like to do is talk to you a little bit about special schools. That's the Oregon State School for the Blind and the Oregon State School for the Deaf. Both of those facilities are housed here in Salem. The School for the Deaf is out on your way to Kaiser, and the School for the Blind is by the Salem Hospital. The School for the Blind was established in 1873 and provides a model learning environment for students who are visually impaired or who have multiple handicaps. Over time, it has become a place where students who have disabilities other than blindness, where they can learn in a setting that is conducive to that. There are 44 students at School for the Blind. It's a residential facility, so most of these students spend the week there and go home on the weekends. Only five actually live in the Salem area and commute daily, so most of them are from around the state and get referred from different ESDs or school districts, depending on the need. 35 of these 44 students do have a disability in addition to their blindness, and the staff total is 56 FTE. The reason we have 56 FTE for only 44 students is because many of these students with the multiple disabilities require one-on-one care, and they require people to be at the facilities overnight since they are spending the night during the week. The school strives to help these children achieve educational success and become lifelong learners by providing such services as Braille and compensatory academics, orientation and mobility, vocational education, living and social skills, and technology skills. And if you go to the School for the Blind, you'll see quite a range of technology, which is another factor that makes the School for the Blind a bit more expensive than other programs. There's a lot of technology to help them use computers. They have a radio station that helps them learn how to communicate within the campus. It's a really great thing, and if you get a chance to go out there and see that, I think you really enjoy that. These are, again, around...
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Could I ask a question, please? I've not heard any horror stories, creepy horror stories, like we've heard about the Oregon State Hospital and the conditions there, which it was built a long time ago as well. So can you assure us that the School for the Blind is a nice facility, that children are well cared for, and we don't have any of these horrible stories?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I can assure you that it is a safe place for children. There are some deferred maintenance needs that we did request a program option package for that didn't get funded. But in general, the school is in good shape, and it is a safe place for children. We also have done a risk assessment of the schools for the blind and deaf, and we can share those results with you at a later date.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, as long as we're on that topic, I would say the same is true for the School for the Deaf as well. It's a safe place for students to be.
I might say, though it may not generate as much concern here, but it probably should, is that I have not been to the school at Hillcrest, but I have been at the one at McLaren. And at least the building that the school is in at McLaren is in relatively good shape, but many buildings at McLaren are in relatively poor shape, and there's a significant issue of deferred maintenance at McLaren. There may be a similar issue at Hillcrest that I'm not aware of also. I did have one question about the School for the Blind, and actually the School for the Deaf also, and this is more of a policy question than actually a budget question. But do students, over the period of their time in school, do they move back and forth between a public school environment and the School for the Blind? How is a determination made whether the student is better served back in their school district or better served at one of the specialized schools?
Mr. Chair, I think that the directors of those two schools are in a better position to answer that question than I am.
Okay.
Anecdotally, I understand that it is more isolating socially to be deaf than it is blind, and it's, I think, in some ways more difficult for those students to move back and forth. The students at the School for the Blind with the multiple handicaps would also find it a bit more difficult, but I think those are policy questions that really deserve to be explored. And we can provide additional detail on the assessment of those students as we progress.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would also want us to talk about these target groups in terms of in a budget-cutting environment, and as we're looking at all the possible reductions, what does that mean? What might the impact be on these particular groups? Are we moving people toward being more vulnerable in some way? Or not? I'd like us to have a discussion that gives us those assurances or not at some point as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we'll certainly do that. And as I understand the Phase 1, Phase 2 process and try to honor that from this side of the table, we will probably address that more in Phase 2 than in this part of the presentation.
Very good. Thank you.
Speaking a little bit more about the School for the Deaf, it was established in 1870 and provides a comprehensive educational program for students who are deaf or hard of hearing. There are 129 children served currently, kindergarten through high school, and half of those children commute daily. We have 100 FTE devoted to those children throughout the year. The educational services provided at the School for the Deaf include speech and language, communications, occupational therapy, physical therapy, audiology, counseling, psychological services, and curriculum. And I think it's important to note that curriculum and instruction are aligned with the state standards that we've been talking about throughout the course of the last couple of days. These specially designed instructional and curriculum materials allow students to make progress at roughly the same rate as children with normal hearing. And again, we'll get into more detail on those on the schools as we move into phase two. The department also administers youth corrections and juvenile detention programs. The youth corrections program itself is intended to provide a high-quality education to all youth in Oregon Youth Authority facilities. And in doing this, staff values standards-based individualized education. We collaborate with all partners, including the youth served, the Oregon Youth Authority, and local school districts and ESDs, so they're partners in providing the education. The services are offered in a safe, secure, and healthy environment for people who are in custody. And the programming that youth receive is also intended to reduce risk factors that lead to recidivism. So part of the thinking there is that if they come out of the youth corrections facilities with a diploma or GED, they'll be on a better track towards being reintegrated into society and not going back into the prison system. Part of that is preparation for community living, and the program offers full-time instruction that is subject, again, to the same standards as public schools throughout the state. We have an average daily attendance of about 815 youth statewide, and there are a variety of settings around the state. And some of the programs that are provided in the youth corrections facilities include welding, graphics, computer and office systems, building constructions, health occupations, and journalism. Again, the major goal is to obtain a diploma or a GED, and the program is funded from the state school fund with the weighting factors that were described yesterday. So for each student at the 1.5 weighting factor, the money that you see in the budget, $24 million, comes out of the state school fund, the $5 billion that you've established for that. Juvenile detention programs are similar, though they are intended for youth housed in 15 county juvenile detention departments, and detention is usually for a short period while they're waiting adjudication, potentially to youth authority institutions. Part of the difficulty with the juvenile detention programs is that the youth are in there for such a short period of time. We can't give them the same type of academic curriculum that you would find in a youth authority setting, but we do focus on basic skills and reading skills, hoping that will prepare them for when they are back into a mainstream program. Next, we'll talk about grant and aid programs, and we'll get into more detail on these than we have with some of the higher level programs. We'll start with the the Oregon pre-kindergarten programs, a slightly different order than you see on the screen. The Oregon pre-K program, as Superintendent Castillo told you on Monday, is her top priority after funding for the state school fund. The Oregon pre-kindergarten program is administered in conjunction with federal Head Start program, and we're tied to many of the federal guidelines. The federal funding for Head Start does not come through the Department of Education, so we won't talk much about it here. That money goes directly from the federal government to their regional offices and then to the local institutions that are providing the services for those children. Focusing on the Oregon pre-K budget, we have Let me say that it's designed for children ages 3 to 4 and providing comprehensive services to the lowest income and highest need families. This is done in partnership with local community programs, and services include preschool, child health, nutrition, and parent education. You'll see, if you do the calculations, that our projected average costs for next biennium are about $8,393 per student. And an obvious question that you might ask is, why is it more expensive for a pre-K program than it is for a regular student in the K-12 system? The reason for that is that in addition to the educational components, we also try and help families set targets. Remember that these are at-risk families, low income, earning less than $18,850 for a family of four. So many of them need help with their family skills, their life skills. Some of these students need help with transportation to get to their programs. And those kind of factors, along with health issues and disability issues, add to the cost of the program a bit. We had requested in the governor's budget a level of funding that would get us up to 70% of all eligible children served. The governor was forced to make decisions based within budget constraints that he was facing, and funding for next biennium will likely take us down to about 52% of eligible youth. And as we mentioned Monday, the funding level is lower than it was in 1999-01. So in this area, we're making some backward progress. The next slide, the next item that we'll talk about is early intervention, early childhood, special education programs. These programs...
Yes.
Mr. West, can you tell us how much more money we would need to get it back to 70%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, our request is about $77 million to get us to that 70% level. So above the $46 million that we currently have in the budget, it would take another $31 million.
Clarification on that, Representative Witz, are you
thank
complete?
You.
That's to get you to the your recommended level, but to get back to the level we were at, which was approximately 60%, it would be what, about 14 million?
Mr.
Well,
Chair,
I get different answers actually every time I ask different sources. So,
Mr. Chair, it would be I think in that neighborhood, but. Linda Ames from the governor's office is also here and helped work through the calculations for the governor's budget. As I recall, the essential budget level was about $14 million higher than what we currently have. But we can be sure and double-check those numbers, coordinate with each other, and give you the same answer this time for a change.
She wasn't showing 14 fingers. She was.
Mr. Chair, Linda Ames with Budget Management. You get two answers because there's really two issues.
Yeah.
The feds have required us to fund, because we try to run a seamless system, to fund the state funding per child at least 90% of the federal expenditures per child. Because of cuts during 0103 and continued into the current biennium, we were well below that. So it takes some dollars to get us back up to 90%, and then some other dollars to fund more children. It's going to be somewhere in the 11 to 14 million
and that's
range.
What would standard, there's a maintenance of effort requirement, and is that what it would be referred to as, or is it, when you say 90% you're speaking, you need to be spending 90% of the federal standard.
Mr. Chair, they...
Per child.
It's the same idea. They don't call it a maintenance of effort requirement.
Okay.
But in order to run the seamless system, and there are some advantages to that, in that the feds pay for certain things like training, in order to have those advantages, they expect the state to run at a certain percent of... And I'm sure you can get more detail on that relationship.
Mr. Chair, I do have a very detailed spreadsheet that we can share with you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the next program we'll talk about is early intervention, early childhood special education. This program is designed for infants, toddlers, and preschools with disabilities and offers connections to community resources for their families. Currently, in the current year, we have about 7,770 children being served, and we project that we'll have 7,925 in next year and 8,085 in fiscal year 06. The average cost for these students is $7,753, and again explained by the fact that these are children with disabilities and we're trying to get them ready to go to school, and it takes more than just educational programs. It also takes some other support services and health-related services.
Clarification on this program. This program is to age 2, correct?
Through age birth to 3, I believe.
To 3.
Yeah.
So when the governor added $5 million to this budget basically to meet some of the additional needs, many of the children that might be coming through this program would be going on to Head Start programs. Would that be a fair assumption? Or
Mr. Chair, we try at all costs to help with community integration of those programs, so they might not necessarily be moving from one program to another, but we may have early childhood special education children integrated into Oregon Pre-Kindergarten or Head Start classrooms.
The reason I asked the question, because it did seem to me that they were different age groups to a large extent, so that...
Mr. Chair, yes, and we're trying to, again, provide from birth through high school services that allow students to succeed all the way. And as we talk more in phase two about the very specifics of those programs, we'll have Nancy Latini, who is our Assistant Superintendent for Special Education, here to talk in greater detail.
Okay. Please proceed. Senator Nelson.
Just a question. On slide 44, where you were talking about the youth corrections, that was $27.2 million. I'm looking off this source of funds for K through 12. So I'm trying to get this. So on that page, it was $27.2 million. Is that a correct figure? And then on 45, are you talking about the next two items on the state grants to districts, which is $199 million, and then federal grants to districts is $998 million? Is that included in this, or is this something different?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, they are two different things. If I could have you take a look just briefly at the legal-sized pages that are in the front of your document, you can see on the fourth page, we talk about the youth corrections and juvenile detention programs. We split those out budgetarily. The $27 million is a combination of other funds that does come from the state school fund and some federal funds. So that is a separate budget unit within our budget. On the next page, you'll see all the programs that we'll be talking about under grant and aid. So the $184 million in general fund for grant and aid that you refer to includes these programs, and it also includes about $754.8 million in federal funds. Some of these programs are funded with a combination of funding. Oregon Pre-K, for example, is almost entirely general fund. The early intervention programs, long-term care and treatment, hospital programs, regional programs have a variety of funding sources that come from state general fund, some of it from the state school fund, as we discussed yesterday, under the funding formula for the special education sub-account, and federal funds.
Yes.
So how much of this is administration costs, and how much is just passed through, and how do you split those things up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, none of the money that you see in these grant and aid programs stays with the department. The only money that we may possibly keep, well, no, we don't keep any of that money. Don't keep any of that money.
It's just passed through.
It's all passed through.
Please proceed.
All right.
Yes, Representative Wisner. Sorry.
I'll follow up to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up to that, do the school districts and are the ESDs, and then the next part of my the representative section over here's questions. What disabilities, could you be more specific, and what's the criteria to equal a disability? And do children exposed to meth, will they come under that program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, I can get more specific on some of the disabilities. We'd be talking about some things like autism, deaf and blind qualify under the special ed programs, learning disabilities qualify. I can't answer specifically if they were meth children, but assuming that those children have learning disabilities that are brought on by their parents' drug abuse, I would assume that they would easily fall under there. And when we can bring you back more detail on that, on the specifics.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So
yes.
That was in the report card. You listed some of the people. I remember that now. But I guess also I'm concerned about mental health. Would it be children that you'd identify in mental health? And could you still address my question about do school districts or ESDs keep any of the pass-through money we're talking to the federal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, yes, I can address that. The money does go out for the ESDs and the school districts to actually provide direct services. That's what the money is for. So most of the money would go into salaries and technology to be able to help those children. There is some money that could be kept for administration, just as there are with all the other federal funds.
Clarification on that. You don't have to provide the clarification today. In some of those funds going through ESDs to school districts, I would believe that some of them would go to ESDs, and the ESDs would provide the service to the school districts. Are there circumstances where those funds would still go through ESDs and there would still be an administrative cost if the funds ultimately ended up with the school district and the school district was providing the service?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, not aware of any sitting here, but we will certainly get back to you with that. The next program that we'll talk about are the regional programs. These are for services for students with low incidence disabilities, and here I can give you a little more detail on what those are. Hearing impairment, vision impairment, deaf blindness, severe orthopedic impairment, and autism are among those that are treated, and students with those disabilities are educated under this program, I should say. The average cost for these students is 2,993 students, or per student. We're currently serving about 6,615 people in these programs. And next year we anticipate that will grow to 6,945. We haven't yet done projections for the following year, but we'll have those done by phase two, I'm sure. This is, again, a combination of general funds, federal funds. So $30.8 million general fund, $10.7 million federal funds. Hospital education programs are education programs for students in acute care hospitals or in state hospitals. We spend a total of about $3.3 million from all fund sources. We have approximately 725 students that are served annually, and they're in five hospitals around the state. And I do have a list of those if you are interested in knowing where those are at. Long-term care and treatment programs are the next program, $17.7 million general fund, $11.3 million federal funds. These are education programs for students in psychiatric, residential, or day treatment facilities. There are 1,131 students being served, and we expect to have about 1,176 next year. The average cost for these students is $12,336. There are 52 contracted programs all around the state where these are happening. Most of these funds do go out to ESDs, and they coordinate or provide the direct services for the programs. The last one we'll talk about before we get into the federal programs, and we'll have Dr. Burke come up and help with that, is the Even Start program. It is a federal program. It's tied to Head Start and to Oregon Pre-K in some ways. It's an integrated family literacy program for early childhood education, and it also is intended to help their parents become literate and have the basic skills they need to help their children succeed in the education that they will be taking advantage of over the next 12 to 15 years. With that, I think what I'll do is have you turn to the tab in your binder that is labeled Federal Funds.
Oh, tiny print.
It is tiny print, but we have some bigger behind it. The spreadsheet that you see here is a list of all the federal programs that we administer, and we had to make a decision about whether it was better to have tiny print or several different pages, which may have been less clear to read. But if you take a look at that, you will see that for each of the programs that we have listed here, we have an office who administers that, the primary responsibility, and I'll give you a little listing of the codes here. OEII is the Office of Educational Innovation and Improvement. OAIS is the Office of Assessment and Information Services. They like to call themselves OASIS. It feels like an OASIS over there sometimes. OFA is the Office of Finance Administration, and OSLP is the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. And the detail that follows this sheet here is in the same order as you see on the spreadsheet. So we have program by program descriptions and funding levels of what each one of the programs are. And I'm not sure how best you would like to proceed, whether it's actually talking about all these programs in great detail or whether the best way is to respond to your questions. That's probably the easiest.
Mr. Chair,
I don't have it. Senator Gourley, yes, I think I know what your question is going to be. But
okay.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. A particular area of interest is the No Child Left Behind funding. There are all kinds of misunderstandings and misstatements out there about exactly how much funding is coming to the state and how it's being allocated. Whatever you can do to clarify would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gourley, that is exactly the reason that we asked Dr. Burke to come up here, because he is an expert in almost everything education related. Of course, I'm sending him up now.
The pressure.
Senator Gourley, actually it was not. Apparently some of us do not have the spreadsheets that you were talking about, but I do believe that it actually, in some cases, at least in mine, was just put in a different area in the book.
Is that the one that is?
It's the one. You have it in front of you.
Yeah, it's, Mr. Chair, it's the document we handed out on Monday,
yeah.
And hopefully is right behind the tab labeled Federal Funds. You do have it right in your hand there, so that's,
yes.
That's a good thing.
And this one, it was under Emergency Board.
While Dr. Burton gets ready to talk about that, there has been discussion about the large increases in federal funds in the governor's budget. I could talk about those just a little bit. We're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $160 million in increases in federal funds for the upcoming biennium. About a third of that is in the child nutrition area and needs to be spent specifically on those programs. Another approximately $53 million of the increase is for Title I of No Child Left Behind and for Individuals with Disabilities Act. So nearly two-thirds of the increase that you see in the governor's budget comes from those three programs and has to be spent specifically for those purposes. One of the questions that continues to come up as well is Can we just use these increases in federal funds to offset either the department operations costs or the costs that local school districts incur in providing education? Almost all of these funds do come with a stipulation that is called supplement, not supplant. And a very basic description of the difference between supplementing and supplanting is these federal funds are intended to provide additional resources on top of the state's resources that are already allocated for education programs. One way to think about that is that the increases, the $53 million increases in Individuals Disability Act funds and No Child Left Behind funds couldn't be used to extend the school year or reduce class sizes unless they were targeted at those specific activities. I think it's important that the committee understands that. Another issue is maintenance of effort. We had discussions with the emergency board during the interim on the maintenance of effort issue. Our conversations were specifically around early intervention, early childhood special education, but they do apply to many federal programs. And the basic description of that is if you spend a given dollar amount in one biennium, you have to spend that same amount in state general funds the next year to match it. A very good example that we have is for the Perkins Professional Technical Program. We have to spend about $840,000 each biennium, or we risk losing some of the federal funds.
Mr. West, I would hope that the committee would note your comments, because sooner or later in this building, there's going to become a discussion that schools have greater federal funds, and the automatic assumption that's going to be made is that their needs are not as great, and there are going to be only a minority of people that will understand that those funds can't be used simply to make up shortages in the governor's budget. And so I would hope that the committee, and I know I will, try to talk to other members in the legislature, because sooner or later that discussion is going to occur. It always does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, please educate me. I'm still, that money does go into the pot. I understand it has to be going to direct funds, but most school districts are going to have those requirements, aren't they? So that is, it is an increase.
It is an increase, Representative Winston, but it's targeted at a specific purpose. It still doesn't address that student that's in a classroom with 37 other students who could probably do better in a classroom with less. It's not as if the money can be used for any purpose that the school district chooses to use it for, or the Department of Education chooses to use it for. It doesn't have that much flexibility in it, I'll put it that way.
I understand that, Mr. Chair, but it can still... The pot of gold that's there, it does increase that amount.
Yeah.
That school district's got to just use that for No Child Left Behind or children with disabilities, mm-hmm. which they would have to do with other funds if they were not there from the federal funds.
Right.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a clarification on this year's sheet here. This is the federal funds encyclopedia summary or whatever it is. The total down here is $510 million. And I look at this other sheet that you gave us, that the federal grants to districts is $998. Where is that all located, the rest of all that $400 million?
Mr. Chair, that $500 million number you're looking at is our projections for the 06-07 fiscal year.
That's biennium?
For the biennium, okay. We're up higher than that.
So this is just a one-year...
Yes, you have three primary columns: the description of the program itself, you have the 05-06, and then 06-07.
Okay.
Broken down by state and local funds.
All right, very good. Keep me on the straight track here.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Dr. Burke, as you are speaking to us about the No Child Left Behind piece, I would appreciate your clarity and helping us understand that the No Child Left Behind dollars do in fact target students who may in fact be in that classroom of 37.
They do.
Students. So if you could help us unpack this understanding, would be very helpful. Thank you.
Dr. Burke, the one thing that I was trying to express in this, and I'll probably try to express it more clearly later, is that a number of specialized programs that we have are devoted to specialized needs. In turn, some of the No Child Left Behind may find itself being devoted to actually closing the achievement gap, which is a very worthy effort. But also, the vast majority of students don't have any of those weighting factors, don't have any of those specialized needs. And the basic amount of funding that's available to those students also has to be adequate. And that's where we have to not only provide, have adequate resources for the student that needs additional assistance or the student that has special needs, but also the student that doesn't have those. And so I'm just trying to get at the fact that sooner or later in this building, as always happens, somebody is going to discover that there are additional federal funds and is going to assume that somehow that covers the gap between the governor's proposed budget and what the school revenue forecast brought forward as the budget. And even the governor is not making that claim. So I just wanted to get us prepared for that, actually, because sooner or later that's going to become a discussion in this building. And Dr. Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what I'd like to do in addressing some of the questions that have just surfaced, there are a couple of basic concepts about federal programs that I could put out on the table that I think help answer some of these because they apply to all federal programs. A couple of key concepts. The first, and I think one of the most important, is the difference between the word supplant and supplement. This is a tricky issue in the 40 years of federal funding under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, but the position of the U.S. Department of Education has been very clear. It is illegal to use federal funds to replace general fund revenue. Federal funds are to supplant it's illegal to supplant. They are to supplement general fund. The related concept is maintenance of effort. So there is a balance between the federal dollar and the state dollar, and it is assumed in the legislation that the federal dollar is supplementing or adding to the effort, which is measured generally by the general fund effort. So we are monitored not only on what is purchased with federal dollars, but also the degree to which there remains a balance between general fund effort at the state level with federal effort. If there is a dramatic reduction in general fund, there is also expected a reduction in expenditure at the federal level. Otherwise, you get into what is called supplanting or replacing general fund reductions with federal dollars. That's illegal, and we would end up we are monitored on that on a regular basis, and we could end up losing federal funds for violating those regulations.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Dr. Burke, and how do they monitor that? Is that through the CAFR every year, or is there some other monitoring?
We have to submit an annual plan every year for these funds. Those plans are reviewed, and then there are on-site visitations. For example, No Child Left Behind, but our funding under the Individuals with Disabilities Act, we went through this past summer, a site visitation from the U.S. Department of Education. They spent a week with us. We just got their letter of findings last week. So we are now looking through their findings. So it's both an annual audit of what we submit. We have a 27-month period within which to spend the funds, and plus regular reporting. So you're always getting new funds, spending out funds that you already have on a rotating basis, and we submit regular reports to the U.S. Department of Education on all of those funds, and they are audited pretty carefully. The other key concept, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is to understand the difference in the terms competitive and categorical. No Child Left Behind contains two types of distribution systems. Some of the funds go to students based on a category. They're fairly straightforward. Title I funds have been, since 1965, when the Act was first passed, distributed on the basis of poverty. And the allocation formula looks at a poverty headcount, the number of students within a school district who meet federal guidelines for poverty. That is typically students who are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. As you've heard from Ms. Fleming earlier in these hearings 2 days ago, the number of low-income families in the state has increased. There has also been an increased level of funding under Title I, and our state has benefited, as other states, in a gradual increase in Title I funding. That's the good news. The bad news is that the forecast for fiscal 06 and fiscal 07 from the U.S. Department of Education is that those increases are beginning to taper off, and looking 2 years out, we expect to see an actual reduction in Title I funding, at least according to the projections that we have right now. But over the last 3 years, under No Child Left Behind, there has been an increase in the state for Title I funding. There are also then that's an example of categorical. Another example are students who for whom English is a second language, and students for whom they meet a definition of migrant status. These are all categories, and funding is distributed to the state based on headcounts of students in those categories. The second idea is competitive. These are funds that are administered by the state but are distributed on the basis of competitive grants. They're not guaranteed to any district. The district has to develop a competitive proposal. Those proposals are submitted to the agency, and we go through a grant awarding process. One of the biggest examples of that is Title IV of No Child Left Behind. And let me just insert here, there's a whole body of jargon around federal funds. Let me just dispel this notion of title. All that simply is are the chapters of the law. Chapter 4 of the law, or Title 4 of the law, relates to safe and drug-free schools and programs that are called 21st Century Learning Community Programs. These are after-school support programs. The funding that is available for the after-school program, the 21st Century Learning Community Program, is administered by the Department of Education, but the distribution is based on competitive grants that come in from school districts. Just 2 weeks ago, we issued our latest round of awards. We distributed about $1.5 million to districts based on their applications. So perhaps I'll stop there and see if there are any questions. Those key concepts of supplanting versus supplementing funding and competitive versus categorical are the two kind of key concepts to understand how federal programs work. And if there are no other questions, I'll move forward. But that's okay. So let's talk a little bit about Title I and get to Senator Gordley's question. Title I is the main part of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and this is the program that provides funding to low-income students, children, schools living in poverty. School districts are eligible for funding based upon their poverty counts. And the school district develops a proposal that is submitted to the agency, and there are two types of programs that are eligible for funding under Title I. I hope, Mr. Chair, to avoid as much jargon as I possibly can. Some Title I programs are called targeted assistance programs, and the other type are called school-wides. And a school-wide program and a targeted assistance program is basically exactly what it says. In a targeted assistance program, the school identifies eligible students. Those are students who are low-income and have academic need, and services are provided specifically to those children. Or targeted assistance or school-wide programs where services are provided to the entire school. in order for a school to be identified as a school-wide program, there has to be a minimum of 40% or more students in the school eligible for free and reduced price lunch. Those programs have to supplement the regular instructional program, and the services that are provided are in the basic skills of English and mathematics, and the target outcome is students who meet or to bring students to a level of meeting or exceeding state standard. So when
Chairman, question. It's very good information, thank you. I can probably ask it to be written down. I'm a visual person, so I don't forget this, but I didn't understand all this, and these terms are very helpful, Dr. Burke. You said the school-wide is distributed, the 40% of the eligible students are eligible to receive free lunches.
Correct.
In Ben Lapine School District, Lapine is eligible. I'm not sure combined they are. Is it by school district or by school?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, it's an excellent question. The funds are distributed to the district. The district then has flexibility on which schools get the funds, with one exception. The funds must be distributed even to the schools in reverse order of poverty. So, but I'll give you a concrete example. A district could decide that it wants to target its Title I allocation to elementary schools, and there are a variety of very good reasons to do that. So even though there might be a high school, for example, where there are a number of students who would qualify by income, the district is not under an obligation to fund that school. The district plan can target its funds. But, for example, just continuing the same example, if it decided to concentrate its funding at the elementary level, it must, by federal law, fund the highest poverty school first. The funds have to be distributed on the basis of poverty. Another strategy or approach that happens in districts is the funds would be allocated on a per-student basis, and they could provide a larger per capita expenditure at the elementary level, a more moderate expenditure at the middle school level, and a lower expenditure at the high school level.
Follow up. I think during the interim we were briefed that there's only a few districts that are receiving the summer food money or something, which is part of this program. Is that correct?
There are some funds under Title I for the summer food program, but the most of the summer food program comes from the Federal Nutrition Act, Federal Lunch and Breakfast Program. That's not part of NCLB, but you're correct. And actually, we have Joyce Daugherty of our staff has actually been working in collaboration with the governor's office to expand the use of the summer meal program around the state. It's a very good program, and in some cases is underutilized, and we've been trying to promote more use of that program.
Thank you.
Dr. Burke, if I could clarify for my own purposes, when you say 40% meeting the requirements for a subsidized school lunch, that is 40% of the district or 40% of the school?
40% of the students in that school.
In that school.
Correct.
So a district that is a varied environment might have actually one or two schools out of 12 or 15 schools that actually meet those requirements.
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct, and that is at the heart of the question and the potential problem that you asked earlier. In a district that has some diversity of income, there will be schools that are not eligible, but even within those schools, they will have students who have not met state standard. There will be other schools that are eligible on the basis of poverty with students who have not met state standard. The more low-income school is eligible for federal funds. The more affluent school is not. So the dilemma that the district faces is how do we provide equitable services to students in need for the schools that are not eligible for federal funding? And to move the Title I funds to an ineligible school is what I mean by the potential problem that occurs. That, in other words, the district would not, under regulation, be able to assign money to an ineligible school.
So, in other words, I'll use a hypothetical example. Let's say a district had two elementary schools that met that Title I requirement and one middle school that met that requirement. But I'm going to make this too complex. But basically, they could not go outside of those three schools, even if they were a school district that had 12 different elementary schools and three different middle schools. They could not go outside those three schools within that district that actually met that requirement.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, but let me also hasten to highlight that you have your finger on exactly why we have been trying to align the state report card system and the federal adequate yearly progress system so that we can develop a more seamless system around the problem that you are identifying. In a more general sense, if a student has need, we ought to be able to find a way to provide help to that student. The regulations somewhat control where the money goes. But let me also point out that that's true under Title I, but there are other elements of this act that are not limited strictly to poverty and do give districts some flexibility in providing services to other schools not driven by poverty. We have been speaking around the state, and you've heard State Superintendent Castillo talk about the same problem. What we have in Oregon is a system that leads to this disparity, this confusion between are they eligible for one type of program or another, and that's where some of the confusion is coming from. How can a school be exemplary on the one hand and not make adequate yearly progress on the other? I think that's generally confusing to the public, and that's why we're trying to integrate these two systems in a more comprehensive manner. There's a lot to talk about in Title I. I don't necessarily want to spend all of our time talking about Title I, but let me point out a couple of other quick points about Title I. Title I-C is a subsection where funding is provided for students of migrant status, which, as we talked about over the last couple of days, is a serious issue in the state of Oregon. The Migrant Education Center, Support Center at Willamette ESD provides a great deal of information on migrant programs around the state. This is an example of what I mean by categorical programs. These funds go where the kids are. They don't go to every district. They go to districts that are impacted by migrant status. Title I funds can be used both for direct service. What I mean by that is teachers and instructional assistants providing direct service to children in basic skills, English and mathematics. They are also available to districts to meet issues of community and parental engagement. Part of your Title I application is to have the districts are required to have a parent involvement policy, and Title I funds can be used and are used to support parental involvement in schools. Let me switch. We could literally, I'm sure, talk about Title I all day. I'd like to talk now about Chapter 2. It's about $28 million of Title II funds. Title II of this law refers to teacher quality. And there is a great deal of flexibility in Title II. Even though funds are distributed to eligible districts based upon the number of eligible children that they have, the use of the funds once the district receives them under Title II is pretty broad. This is, Mr. Chair, an example of where funds are not necessarily restricted just to low-income schools, and they are to provide for the improvement of teachers in the schools. So they are essentially professional development funds. They can also be used for recruitment of teachers. They can be used for providing incentives to teachers to work in high-need schools. They can be used to work with paraprofessionals to improve their skills. So Title II is right now one of the major sources of professional development funding in our schools, because many districts have had to cut back out of their general fund resources for teacher professional development. Title II gives them that opportunity. There is, however...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Dr. Burke, are there any funds in that for teacher mentoring programs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, thank you for the question. Mentoring and programs for induction and bringing new teachers into the profession are some of the allowable cost under Title II. So if a district decides to provide a mentoring program, it can. It is not, however, at the same level, I would say, as you recall, the Oregon Beginning Teacher and Mentor Act had in it a target of $3,000 per new employee of state funds. Two sessions ago, those funds were removed from the law and haven't been restored, and I would say that there's really not enough money in Title II to offset that type of loss for every beginning teacher. But districts, if they want to use some of their Title II money for mentoring, that is an allowable cost.
Oh, okay, and Mr. Chair, a follow-up. So that doesn't mean that every district will use it. It's a choice that they're making.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, absolutely.
Mm.
And that, let me, you committee asked a question earlier, I believe it was Senator Nelson, about how do we know what the districts are doing? I think it's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we'd have to talk about the state system and the federal system, but in some ways they operate in the same basic same way. Districts are required to submit their improvement plans to us, and we review those plans. And what we did is we integrated these plans last year. It used to be that there was a separate district improvement plan and a separate consolidated sub-grant application. That's a fancy term for what were they going to do with their federal money. And they came in separately. So, Senator Nelson, to your question, we knew, but as Ms. Fleming and Mr. West have described, we knew within silos. Some people in the agency knew some things, and other people in the agency knew other things. So in integrating this system, we have put together their planning process and their funding process into a single plan. And we can look at it collectively and look at it together. Now, that means we get approximately 198 plans. Do we do the same level of detail with every plan? And the answer is no. There's a certain amount of judgment that we have to make, and it is all based on performance. So when we see evidence that a district is not improving or that students aren't meeting expectations, that's where those plans receive greater scrutiny. Not only what is the plan, but what's the money behind the plan. So what's the evidence? Well, right now there are two sources of evidence. One is the state report card, and the other is the federal adequate yearly progress report. So we would then narrow our focus. There are currently 36 schools in the state report card that were listed as low or unacceptable. Those schools get scrutiny by our agency. There were 356 schools that did not make adequate yearly progress. There are requirements under the federal law for us to review the plans of those schools as a first step, and those plans actually escalate over time for more intensive intervention on our part if the schools are Title I schools. That's an area where there has been a lot of confusion, and I know there has because we get calls about this all the time. The federal consequences apply only to the schools that are Title I funded in the district. So that, when we reported this at the same time of year this year, so the newspapers were reporting some schools that were unsatisfactory on the state report card and other schools that had not made adequate yearly progress. In both cases, there is a review of their plan and a review of their spending plan. So, for example, if it turns out that a school, either on the state report card or on the federal plan, was not making progress because of students for whom English was their second language, and we review their plan and their spending plan, and there's nothing in there about professional development for their staff related to that target population, that's where we intervene with the district and begin to ask deeper questions about how good is the plan, are you targeting the data, and have you aligned the resources to your plan. And Senator Nelson, I'd like to be able to tell you that we could do that with all 198 school districts simultaneously. We don't have the capacity to do that. That's why we're trying to build more regional capacity at the ESD level to help with that district improvement process. But when we see evidence that that progress is not being made, that plan becomes the framework that we dig in and see what we can do to improve.
Dr. Burke, at this point, if you could close up in about 1 minute, not finish your presentation because we will go on tomorrow, but we will be adjourning here in about 1 or 2 minutes.
I will, Mr. Chair. I want to make one quick distinction in Title II because some of your districts in the areas you represent have done this. Districts have an option under Title II to use Title II money to lower class size. And in order for them to do that, they can move Title II money into teacher salary. Now, this is, again, remember, key concept, supplant versus supplement. They have to staff at the general fund level first. Then if they want to add additional teachers, they can use Title II money to do that. And many districts have decided to do that. Senator Gordley, I'm sure, is familiar with this. That is what Portland Public Schools decided to do with its Title II money, for as an example. They put money into elementary supplemental positions to lower first, second, and third grade class sizes. And they do have an option under Title II to make that choice. Again, we don't try to dictate to the districts what they do. We manage for results. If they're getting results, we continue to support the districts. If we see that progress is not being made, then we're looking at those plans in more detail. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. If there are no additional questions, we will adjourn till tomorrow morning at 8:30. And if we should need more time for the Department of Education, if we go beyond tomorrow, we'll try to modify the schedule next week a little bit so that maybe we end up having to use part of Monday or maybe even all of Monday, depending upon how much questions there are tomorrow. When we started this process, I was a little bit concerned that there would not be enough information to keep the committee busy for 2 hours and enough questions. And that I have changed my opinion in the last 3 days. So. With that, we are adjourned until tomorrow morning.